in the corner. I think so, it did last week. May I? Please. Nicholas punched the on button and inserted the tape. You remember the guy I saw in court last week, the one who was following me? Yes. Harkins stood and walked to within 2 feet of the TV screen. I remember. Well, here he is. In black and white, a little fuzzy but certainly clear enough to distinguish, the door opened and the man entered Easter's apartment. He looked around, anxiously, and for one very long second seemed to look in the precise direction of the camera, hidden in an air vent above the refrigerator. Nicholas stopped the video in full frontal shot of the man's face and said, "That's him." Judge Harkin repeated without breathing, "Yeah, that's him." The tape continued with the man, Doyle, coming and going from view, taking pictures, leaning close to the computer, then leaving in less than 10 minutes. The screen went black. "When did," Harkin asked slowly, still staring, "Saturday afternoon. I worked an 8-hour shift and this guy broke in while I was on the job." Not entirely true, but Harkin would never know the difference. Nicholas had reprogrammed the video to reflect last Saturday's time and date in the lower right corner. "Why do you—" "I was robbed and beaten 5 years ago and I lived in Mobile. Almost died. Happened during a break into my apartment. I'm careful about security, that's all." And this made it all perfectly plausible, the existence of sophisticated surveillance equipment in a run-down apartment, the computers and cameras on a minimum-wage salary. The man was terrified of violence. Everybody could understand that. "You want to see it again?" "No, that's him." Nicholas removed the tape and handed it to the judge. "Keep it. I have another copy." Fitch's roast beef sandwich was interrupted when Conrad pecked on the door and uttered the words Fitch longed to hear. "The girl's on the phone." He wiped his mouth and his goatee with the back of a hand and grabbed the phone. "Hello?"
"Fitch, baby," she said. "It's me, Marley."
"Yes, dear."
"Don't know the guy's name, but he's the goon you sent into Easter's apartment on Thursday the 19th, 11 days ago, at 4:52 p.m. to be exact."
Fitch gasped for breath and coughed up specks of sandwich. He cursed silently and stood up straight. She continued,
"It was just after I gave you the note about Nicholas wearing a gray golf shirt and starched khakis, you remember?"
"Yes," he said hoarsely.
"Anyway, you later sent the goon into the courtroom, probably to look for me. It was last Wednesday, the 25th. Pretty stupid move, because Easter recognized the man and he sent a note to the judge, who also got an eyeful. Are you listening, Fitch?"
"Listening but not breathing." "Yes," he snapped.
"Well, now the judge knows the guy broke into Easter's apartment, and he signed a warrant for the guy's arrest. So get him out of town immediately, or you're about to be embarrassed. Maybe arrested yourself."
100 questions raced wildly through Fitch's brain, but he knew they wouldn't be answered. If Doyle somehow got recognized and taken in, and if he said too much, then, well, it was unthinkable. Breaking and entering was a felony anywhere on the planet, and Fitch had to move fast. "Anything else?" he said.
"No, that's all for now."
Doyle was supposed to be eating at a window table in a dinky Vietnamese restaurant 4 blocks from the courthouse, but was in fact playing $2 blackjack at the Lucy Luck when the beeper erupted on his belt. It was Fitch at the office. 3 minutes later, Doyle was headed east on Highway 90, east because the Alabama state line was closer than Louisiana. 2 hours later, he was flying to Chicago. It took Fitch an hour to dig and determine that no arrest warrant had been issued for Doyle Dunlap, nor for any unnamed person resembling him. This was of no comfort. The fact remained that Marley knew they'd entered Easter's apartment. But how did she know? That was the great and troubling question. Fitch yelled at Conrad and Pang behind locked doors. It would be 3 hours before they found the answer. At 3:30 Monday, Judge Harkin called a halt to Dr. Kielvan's testimony and sent him home for the day. He announced to the surprised lawyers that there were a couple of serious matters involving the jury that had to be dealt with immediately. He sent the jurors back to their room and ordered all spectators out of the courtroom. Jip and Rasko herded them away, then locked the door. Oliver McAdoo gently slid the briefcase under the table with his long left foot until the camera was aimed at the bench.
Next to it were four other assorted satchels and cases, along with two large cardboard boxes filled with bulky depositions and other legal refuse. McAdoo was not sure what was about to happen, but he assumed correctly that Fitch would want to see it. Judge Harkin cleared his throat and addressed the horde of lawyers watching him intently. "Gentlemen, it has come to my attention that some, if not all, of our jurors feel as if they're being watched and followed. I have clear proof that at least one of our jurors has been the victim of a break-in." He allowed this to sink in, and sink in it did. The lawyers were stunned, each side knowing full well it was innocent of any wrongdoing and immediately placing guilt where it belonged, at the other table. "Now I have two choices. I can declare a mistrial, or I can sequester the jury. I'm inclined to pursue the latter, as distasteful as it will be. Mr. Rohr?" Rohr was slow to rise, and for a rare moment could think of little to say.
Gee, Judge, we'd sure hate to see a mistrial. I mean, I'm certain that we've done nothing wrong." He glanced at the defense table as he said this. "Someone broke in on a juror?" he asked.
"That's what I said. I'll show you the proof in a moment, Mr. Cable."
Sir Durr stood and buttoned his jacket right properly.
"This is quite shocking, Your Honor."
"Certainly is.
I'm really in no position to respond until I hear more," he said, returning the look of utter suspicion to the lawyers who were obviously guilty, the plaintiffs. "Very well, bring in juror number 4, Stella Hulick," His Honor instructed Willis. Stella was stiff with fear and already pale by the time she re-entered the courtroom. "Please take a seat in the witness stand, Mrs. Hulick. This won't take but a minute."
The judge smiled with great assurance and waved at the chair in the witness box. Stella shot wild looks in all directions as she sat down.
"Thank you. Now, Mrs. Hulick, I want to ask you just a few questions."
The courtroom was still and silent as the lawyers held their pens and ignored their sacred legal pads and waited for a great secret to be revealed. After 4 years of pretrial warfare, they knew virtually everything that every witness would say beforehand. The prospect of unrehearsed statements coming from the witness stand was fascinating. Surely she was about to reveal some heinous sin committed by the other side. She looked up pitifully at the judge. Someone had smelled her breath and squealed on her.
"Did you go to Miami over the weekend?"
"Yes, sir,"
she answered slowly.
"With your husband?"
"Yes."
Cal had left the courtroom before lunch. He had deals to attend to.
"And what was the purpose of this visit?"
"To shop."
"Did anything unusual happen while you were there?"
She took a deep breath and looked at the eager lawyers packed around the long tables. Then she turned to Judge Harkin and said,
"Yes, sir."
"Please tell us what happened."
Her eyes watered, and the poor woman was about to lose control. Judge Harkin seized the moment and said,
"It's okay, Mrs. Hulick, you've done nothing wrong. Just tell us what happened."
She bit her lip and clenched her teeth.
"We got in Friday night to the hotel, and after we'd been there for 2, maybe 3 hours, a phone rang, and it was some woman who told us that these men from the tobacco companies were following us. She said they'd followed us from Biloxi, and they knew our flight numbers and everything. Said they'd follow us all weekend, might even try to bug our phones."
Rohr and his squad breathed in relief. One or two shot nasty looks at the other table, where Cable et al. Were frozen.
"Did you see anybody following you?"
"Well, frankly, I never left the room. It upset me so. My husband Cal ventured out a few times, and he did see this one guy, some Cuban-looking man with a camera on the beach. Then he saw the same guy on Sunday as we were checking out."
It suddenly hit Stella that this was her exit, her one moment to appear so overcome she just couldn't continue. With little effort, the tears began to flow.
"Anything else, Mrs. Hulick?"
"No,"
she said, sobbing.
"It's just awful. I can't keep..."
And the words were lost in anguish. His Honor looked at the lawyers.
"I'm going to excuse Mrs. Hulick and replace her with alternate number 1.
A small wail went up from Stella, and with the poor woman in such misery it was impossible to argue that she should be kept. Sequestration was looming, and there was no way she could keep pace.
You may return to the jury room, get your things, and go home. Thank you for your service, and I'm sorry this has happened.
I'm so sorry,
she managed to whisper, then rose from the witness chair and left the courtroom. Her departure was a blow for the defense. She'd been rated highly during selection, and after 2 weeks of non-stop observation, the jury experts on both sides were of the near unanimous opinion that she was not sympathetic to the plaintiff. She had smoked for 24 years without once trying to stop. Her replacement was a wild card, feared by both sides, but especially by the defense.
"Bring in juror number two, Nicholas Easter," Harkins said to Willis, who was standing with the door open.
As Easter was being called for, Gloria Lane and an assistant rolled a large TV VCR to the center of the courtroom. The lawyers began chewing their pens, especially the defense. Durwood Cable pretended to be preoccupied with other matters on the table, but the only question on his mind was, what has Fitch done now? Before the trial, Fitch directed everything, the composition of the defense team, the selection of expert witnesses, the hiring of jury consultants, the actual investigation of all prospective jurors. He handled the delicate communications with the client, Pynex, and he watched the plaintiff's lawyers like a hawk. But most of what Fitch did after the trial began was quite secretive. Cable didn't want to know. He took the high road and tried the case, let Fitch play in the gutter and try to win it. Easter sat in the witness chair and crossed his legs. If he was scared or nervous, he didn't show it. The judge asked him about the mysterious man who'd been following him, and Easter gave specific times and places where he'd seen the man. And he explained in perfect detail what happened last Wednesday when he glanced across the courtroom and saw the same man sitting out there on the third row. He then described the security measures he'd taken in his apartment, and he took the videotape from Judge Harkin. He inserted it in the VCR, and the lawyers sat on the edge of their seats. He ran the tape, all 9.5 minutes of it, and when it stopped, he sat again in the witness chair and confirmed the identity of the intruder. It was the same man who'd been following him, the same guy who'd shown up in court last Wednesday. Fitch couldn't see the damn monitor through his hidden camera because Bigfoot McAdoo or some other klutz had kicked the briefcase under the table. But Fitch heard every word Easter said, and he could close his eyes and see precisely what was happening in the courtroom. A severe headache was forming at the base of his skull. He gulped aspirin and washed it down with mineral water. He'd love to ask Easter a simple question. For one concerned enough about security to install hidden cameras, why didn't you install an alarm system on your door? But the question occurred to no one but himself. His Honor said, "I can also verify that the man in the video was in this courtroom last Wednesday." But the man in the video was now long gone. Doyle was safely tucked away in Chicago when the courtroom saw him enter the apartment and slink around as if he'd never get caught.
"You may return to the jury room, Mr. Easter."
An hour passed as the lawyers made their rather feeble and unprepared arguments for and against sequestration. Once things warmed up, allegations of wrongdoing began to fly back and forth, with the defense catching the most flack. Both sides knew things they couldn't prove and thus couldn't say, so the accusations were left somewhat broad. The jurors got a full report from Nicholas, an embellished account of everything that happened both in court and in the video. In his haste, Judge Harkin had failed to prohibit Nicholas from discussing the matter with his colleagues. It was an omission Nicholas had immediately caught, and he couldn't wait to structure the story to suit himself. He also took the liberty of explaining Stella's rapid departure. She'd left them in tears. Fitch narrowly averted 2 minor strokes as he stomped around his office, rubbing his neck and his temples and tugging at his goatee and demanding impossible answers from Conrad, Swanson, and Pang. In addition to those three, he had young Holly and Joe Boy, a local private eye with incredibly soft feet, and Dante, a black ex-cop from D.C., and Dubaz, another coast boy with a lengthy record, and he had 4 people in the office with Conrad, another 12 he could summon to Biloxi within 3 hours, and loads of lawyers and jury consultants. Fitch had lots of people, and they cost lots of money, but he damn sure didn't send anyone to Miami over the weekend to watch Stella and Cal shop. A Cuban with a camera? Fitch actually threw a phone book against a wall as he repeated this. What if it's the girl? asked Pang, raising his head slowly after lowering it to miss the phone book.
What girl?
Marley. Hulick said the phone call came from a girl. Pang's composure was a sharp contrast to his boss's explosiveness. Fitch froze in mid-step, then sat for a moment in his chair. He took another aspirin and drank more mineral water and finally said,
I think you're right.
And he was. The Cuban was a two-bit security consultant Marley found in the Yellow Pages. She'd paid him $200 to look suspicious, not a difficult task, and to get caught with a camera as the Hulicks left the hotel. The 11 jurors and 3 alternates were reassembled in the courtroom. Stella's empty chair on the first row was filled by Philip Savell, a 48-year-old misfit neither side had been able to read. He described himself as a self-employed tree surgeon, but no record of this profession had been found on the Gulf Coast for the past 5 years. He was also an avant-garde glassblower, whose forte was brightly colored, shapeless creations to which he gave obscure aquatic and marine names and occasionally exhibited at tiny, neglected galleries in Greenwich Village. He boasted of being an expert sailor and had in fact once built his own catch, which he sailed to Honduras, where it sank in calm waters. At times he fancied himself an archaeologist, and after the boat dropped he spent 11 months in a Honduran prison for illegal excavations. He was single, agnostic, a graduate of Grinnell, a non-smoker. Savell scared the hell out of every lawyer in the courtroom. Judge Harkin apologized for what he was about to do. Sequestration of a jury was a rare, radical event, made necessary by extraordinary circumstances and almost always used in sensational murder cases. But he had no choice in this case. There had been unauthorized contact. There was no reason to believe it would cease, regardless of his warnings. He didn't like it one bit, and he was very sorry for the hardship it would cause. But his job at this point was to guarantee a fair trial. He explained that months earlier he had developed a contingency plan for this very moment. The county had reserved a block of rooms at a nearby unnamed motel. Security would be increased. He had a list of rules which he would cover with them. The trial was now entering its second full week of testimony, and he would push the lawyers hard to finish as soon as possible. The 15 jurors were to leave, go home, pack, get their affairs in order, and report to court the next morning, prepared to spend the next 2 weeks sequestered. There were no immediate reactions from the panel. They were too stunned. Only Nicholas Easter thought it was funny. Chapter 14. Because of Jerry's fondness for beer and gambling and football and rowdiness in general, Nicholas suggested they meet at a casino Monday night to celebrate their last few hours of freedom. Jerry thought it was a wonderful idea. As the two left the courthouse, they toyed with the idea of inviting a few of their colleagues. The idea sounded good, but it didn't work. Herman was out of the question. Lonnie Shaver left hurriedly, quite agitated and not speaking to anyone. Savell was new and unknown, and apparently the kind of guy you'd keep at a distance. That left Herrera, Knapp the colonel, and they simply weren't up to it. They were about to spend 2 weeks locked up with him. Jerry invited Sylvia Taylor Tatum, the poodle. The two were becoming friends of a sort. She was divorced for the second time, and Jerry was about to be divorced for the first. Since Jerry knew all the casinos along the coast, he suggested they meet at a new one called the Diplomat. It had a sports bar with a large screen, cheap drinks, a little privacy, and cocktail waitresses with long legs and skimpy outfits. When Nicholas arrived at 8, Poodle was already there, holding a table in the crowded bar, sipping a draft beer and smiling pleasantly, something she never did inside the courthouse. Her flowing curly hair was pulled back. She wore tight, faded jeans, a bulky sweater, and red cowboy boots. Still far from pretty, she looked much better in a bar than in the jury box. Sylvia had the dark, sad, worldly eyes of a woman beaten by life, and Nicholas was determined to dig as fast and as deep as possible before Fernandez arrived. He ordered another round and dispensed with the chit-chat. "Are you married?" he asked, knowing she wasn't. The first marriage had occurred when she was 19, had produced twin boys, now 20. One worked offshore on an oil rig, the other was a junior in college, very opposite. Husband one left after 5 years, and she raised the boys herself. "What about you?" she asked. No, technically I'm still a student, but I'm working now. Husband two was an older man, and thankfully they produced no children. The marriage lasted 7 years, then he traded her in for a newer model. She vowed to never marry again. The Bears kicked off to the Packers, and Sylvia watched the game with interest. She loved football because her boys had been all-conference picks in high school. Jerry arrived in a rush, casting wary glances behind him before apologizing for being late. He gulped down the first beer in a matter of seconds and explained that he thought he was being followed. Poodle scoffed at this and offered the opinion that right now every member of the jury was jerking at the neck, certain that shadows were not far behind.
"Forget the jury," Jerry said. "I think it's my wife."
"Your wife?" said Nicholas.
"Yeah, I think she's got some private snoop trailing me."
"You should look forward to being sequestered," Nicholas said.
"Oh, I am," Jerry said, winking at Poodle.
He had $500 on the Packers, plus 6 points, but the bet was only for the combined score in the first half. He'd place another bet at halftime. Any pro or college game offered an amazing array of bets, he explained to the two novices seated with him, virtually none of which had anything to do with the ultimate winner. Jerry sometimes bet on who'd fumble first, who'd make the first field goal, who'd throw the most interceptions. He watched the game with the edginess of a man wagering money he could ill afford to lose. He drank 4 draft beers in the first quarter. Nicholas and Sylvia fell quickly behind. In the gaps of Jerry's incessant chatter about football and the art of successful betting, Nicholas made a few awkward forays into the subject of the trial, without success. Sequestration was a sore subject, and since they had not yet experienced it, there was little to say. The day's testimony had been painful enough to sit through, and the thought of rehashing Dr. Kielvan's opinions during leisure seemed cruel. Nor was there interest in the bigger picture. Sylvia in particular was disgusted by a simple inquiry into the general concept of liability. Mrs. Grimes had been ushered from the courtroom and was in the atrium when Judge Harkin announced his rules for sequestration. As she drove Herman home, he explained that he'd be spending the next 2 weeks in a motel room on strange turf without her around. Shortly after they reached their house, she had Judge Harkin on the phone and gave him an earful of her thoughts on these most recent developments. Her husband was blind, she reminded him more than once, and he needed special assistance. Herman sat on the sofa, drinking his one beer of the day and fuming at his wife's intrusion. Judge Harkin quickly found middle ground. He would allow Mrs. Grimes to stay with Herman in his room at the motel. She could eat breakfast and dinner with Herman and care for him, but she had to avoid contact with the other jurors. Also, she could no longer watch the trial, because it was imperative that she not be able to discuss it with Herman. This didn't sit well with Mrs. Grimes, one of the few spectators who'd heard every word so far. And though she didn't reveal this to his honor or to Herman, she had already developed some rather strong opinions about the case. The judge was firm. Herman was furious. But Mrs. Grimes prevailed and set off to the bedroom to begin packing. Lonnie Shaver did a week's work Monday night at the office. After numerous attempts, he found George Teeker at home in Charlotte and explained that the jury was about to be locked away for the duration of the trial. He was scheduled to talk to Taunton later in the week, and he was worried about being inaccessible. He explained that the judge was prohibiting any direct phone calls to and from the motel room, and it would be impossible to correspond again until after the trial. Teeker was sympathetic, and as the conversation progressed, he expressed somber concerns about the outcome of the trial. "Our people in New York think an adverse verdict could send shockwaves through the retail economy, especially in our business. God knows where insurance rates will go." "I'll do what I can," Lonnie promised. "Surely the jury isn't serious about a big verdict, is it?" "Hard to tell right now. We're halfway through the plaintiff's case. It's just too early." "You've got to protect us on this, Lonnie. I know it puts you in the bullseye, but damn, you just happen to be there. Know what I mean?"
"Yeah, I understand. I'll do what I can."
"We're counting on you up here. Hang in there." The confrontation with Fitch was brief and went nowhere. Durwood Cable waited until almost 9 Monday night, when the offices were still busy with trial preparation and a late catered dinner was being completed in the conference room. He asked Fitch to step into his office. Fitch obliged, though he wanted to leave and return to the dime store.
I'd like to discuss a matter, Durr said stiffly, standing on his side of his desk.
What is it?
Fitch barked, choosing also to stand with hands on hips. He knew exactly what Cable had in mind. We were embarrassed in court this afternoon.
You were not embarrassed. As I recall, the jury was not present, so whatever happened was of no consequence to the final verdict.
You got caught and we got embarrassed.
I did not get caught.
Then what do you call it?
I call it a lie. We did not send people to follow Stella Hulick. Why would we do that?
Then who called her?
I don't know, but it certainly wasn't any of our people. Any more questions?
Yeah, who was the guy in the apartment?
He was not one of my men. I didn't get to see the video, you understand, so I didn't see his face, but we have reason to believe he was a goon employed by Rohr and his boys.
Can you prove this?
I don't have to prove a damn thing, and I don't have to answer any more questions. Your job is to try this lawsuit, and you let me worry about security.
Don't embarrass me, Fitch.
And don't you embarrass me by losing this trial.
I rarely lose.
Fitch turned and headed for the door.
I know. And you're doing a fine job, Cable. You just need a little help from the outside.
Nicholas arrived first, with two gym bags stuffed with clothes and toiletries. Lou Dell and Willis and another deputy, a new one, were waiting in the hallway outside the jury room to collect the bags and store them for a while in an empty witness room. It was 8:20 Tuesday. How do the bags get from here to the motel? Nicholas asked, still holding his and quite suspicious.
We'll haul them over sometime during the day, Willis said, but we have to inspect him first.
I'll be damned.
I beg your pardon?
No one is inspecting these bags, Nicholas pronounced and stepped into the empty jury room.
Judge's orders, said Lou Dell, following.
I don't care what the judge has ordered. No one is inspecting my bags. He placed them in a corner, walked to the coffee pot, and said to Willis and Lou Dell in the doorway, Leave, okay? This is the jury room. They shuffled backward, and Lou Dell closed the door. A minute passed before there were words in the hallway. Nicholas opened the door and saw Millie Dupree, sweat lining her forehead, confronting Lou Dell and Willis with two huge Samsonite suitcases.
They think they're going to inspect our bags, but they're not, Nicholas explained. Let's put them in here.
He grabbed the nearest and, with great effort, lifted it and hauled it to the same corner in the jury room.
Judge's orders, Lou Dell was heard to mumble.
We're not terrorists, Nicholas snapped, heaving. What's he think we're going to do, smuggle in some guns or drugs or something?
Millie grabbed a donut and expressed her gratitude to Nicholas for protecting her privacy. There were things in there that, well, she just wouldn't want men such as Willis, or anybody for that matter, to touch or feel.
Leave!
Nicholas yelled, pointing at Lou Dell and Willis, who again retreated into the hallway. By 8:45, all 12 jurors were present, and the room was cramped with baggage Nicholas had rescued and stored. He'd ranted and raved and grown angrier with each new load, and had done a fine job of whipping the jury into a nasty bunch ready for a showdown. At 9, Lou Dell knocked on the door, then turned the knob to enter. The door was locked from the inside. She knocked again. In the jury room, no one moved but Nicholas. He walked to the door, said,
Who is it? Lou Dell, it's time to go. The judge is ready for you. Tell the judge to go to hell.
Lou Dell turned to Willis, who was bug-eyed and reaching for his rusty revolver. The harshness of his reply startled even some of the angrier jurors, but there was no break in their unity.
What did you say?
Lou Dell asked. There was a loud click, then the doorknob turned. Nicholas walked into the hallway and closed the door behind him.
Tell the judge we're not coming out,
he said, glaring down at Lou Dell and her dirty gray bangs.
You can't do that,
Willis said as aggressively as possible, which was not aggressive at all, but rather feeble.
Shut up, Willis.
The excitement of jury trouble lured people back to the courtroom Tuesday morning. Word had spread quickly that one juror had been bounced and that another had had his apartment broken into, and that the judge was angry and had ordered the entire panel locked up. Rumors ran wild, the most popular of which was the one about a tobacco snoop actually getting caught in a juror's apartment and a warrant being issued for his arrest. Cops and FBI were looking everywhere for the man.
The morning papers from Biloxi, New Orleans, Mobile, and Jackson ran large stories either on the front page or front page metro. The courthouse regulars were back in droves. Most of the local bars suddenly had pressing business in the courtroom and loitered about. A half dozen reporters from various papers held the front row, plaintiff's side. The boys from Wall Street, a group that had been dwindling as its members discovered casinos and deep-sea fishing and long nights in New Orleans, were back in full force. And so there were many witnesses to the sight of Lou Dell nervously tiptoeing through the jury door across the front of the courtroom to the bench, where she leaned up and Harkin leaned down and they conferred. Harkin's head cocked sideways as if he didn't catch it at first. Then he looked blankly at the jury door, where Willis was standing with his shoulders up in a frozen shrug. Lou Dell finished delivering her message and walked quickly back to where Willis was waiting. Judge Harkin studied the inquiring faces of the lawyers, then looked at all the spectators out there. He scribbled something he couldn't read himself. He pondered about what to do next. His jury was on strike. And what exactly did his judge's handbook say about that? He pulled his microphone closer and said, "Gentlemen, there's a small problem with the jury. I need to go speak with them. I'll ask Mr. Roy and Mr. Cable to assist me. Everyone else is to remain in place." The door was locked again. The judge knocked politely, three light raps followed by a twist of the doorknob. It wouldn't open. "Who is it?" came a male voice from inside. "It's Judge Harkin," he said loudly. Nicholas was standing at the door. He turned and smiled at his colleagues. Millie Dupree and Mrs. Gladys Card were hovering in a corner near a pile of luggage, fidgeting nervously, afraid of jail or whatever the judge might throw at them. But the other jurors were still indignant. Nicholas unlocked the door and opened it. He smiled pleasantly as if nothing were wrong, as if strikes were a routine part of trials. "Come in," he said. Harkin, in a gray suit, no robe, entered, with Roar and Cable in tow. "What's the problem here?" he asked while surveying the room. Most of the jurors were seated at the table with coffee cups and empty plates and newspapers scattered everywhere. Philip Savell stood alone at one window. Lonnie Shaver sat in a corner with a laptop on his knees. Easter was no doubt the spokesman and probably the instigator. "We don't think it's fair for the deputies to search our bags."
"And why not?"
"It should be obvious. These are our personal effects. We're not terrorists or drug smugglers, and you're not a customs agent." Easter's tone was authoritative, and the fact that he spoke so boldly to a distinguished judge made most of the jurors very proud. He was one of them. Undoubtedly their leader, regardless of what Herman thought, and he had told them more than once that they, not the judge, not the lawyers, not the parties, but they, the jurors, were the most important people in this trial. "It's routine in all sequestration cases," His Honor said, taking a step closer to Easter, who was 4 inches taller and not about to be cowered. "But it's not in black and white, is it? In fact, I'll bet it's a simple matter of discretion with the presiding judge. True?"
"There are some good reasons for it."
"Not good enough. We're not coming out, Your Honor, until you promise our bags will be left alone." Easter said this with a tight jaw and semi-snarl, and it was evident to the judge and the lawyers that he meant it. He was also speaking for the group. No one else had moved. Harkin made the mistake of glancing over his shoulder at Roar, who couldn't wait to add a few thoughts.
"Oh, hell, Judge, what's the big deal?" he blurted. "These folks aren't carrying plastic explosives."
"That's enough," Harkin said, but Roar had managed to curry a slight favor with the jury. Cable, of course, felt the same, and wanted to convey his heartfelt trust in whatever the jurors had packed in their American Touristers, but Harkin didn't give him the chance.
"Very well," His Honor said, "the bags will not be searched. But if it comes to my attention that any juror possesses any item prohibited by the list I handed out yesterday, then that juror will be in contempt of court and subject to being jailed. Do we understand?"
Easter looked around the room, took the measure of each of his fellow jurors, most of whom appeared relieved, and a few of whom were actually nodding. "That's fine, Judge," he said.
"Good. Now can we get on with the trial?"
"Well, there's one other problem."
"What is it?"
Nicholas lifted a sheet of paper from the table, read something, then said, "According to your rules here, we're allowed one conjugal visit per week. We think we should get more."
"How many?"
"As many as possible." This was news to most of the jurors. There had been some grumbling among some of the men, Easter and Fernandez and Lonnie Shaver in particular, about the number of conjugal visits, but the women had not discussed it. Particularly, Mrs. Gladys Card and Millie Dupree were downright embarrassed to have His Honor think they were insisting on having as much sex as they could get. Mr. Card had had prostate trouble years earlier, and, well, Mrs. Gladys Card thought about divulging this to clear her good name when Herman Grimes said, "Two'll do me." The image of old Herm feeling his way around under the covers with Mrs. Grimes could not be denied and provoked laughter that broke the tension.
"I don't think we should take a survey," Judge Harkins said. "Can we agree on two? We're just talking about a couple weeks, folks."
"Two with a possible third," Nicholas counteroffered.
"That's fine. Does that suit everyone?"
His Honor looked around the room. Lorene Duke was giggling to herself at the table. Mrs. Gladys Card and Millie were trying their best to disappear into the walls and would not, under any circumstances, look the judge in the eyes.
"Yes, that's fine," said Jerry Fernandez, red-eyed and hungover.
If Jerry went a day without sex, he developed headaches. But he knew two things. His wife was delighted to have him out of the house for the next 2 weeks, and he and Poodle would work out an arrangement.
"I object to the wording of this,"
Philip Savelle said from the window, his first words of the trial. He was holding the sheet of rules.
"Your definition of the persons eligible to participate in conjugal visits leaves something to be desired."
In clear English, the offending section read, "During each conjugal visit, each juror may spend 2 hours alone and in his or her room with his or her spouse, girlfriend, or boyfriend." Judge Harkin, along with the two lawyers looking over his shoulder and every juror in the room, read the language carefully and wondered what in the world this weirdo had in mind. But Harkin was not about to find out.
"I assure you, Mr. Savelle, and members of the jury, I have no plans to restrict any of you in any way with respect to your conjugal visits. I don't care what you do or whom you do it with, frankly."
This seemed to satisfy Savelle as much as it humiliated Mrs. Gladys Card.
"Now, anything else?"
"That's all, Your Honor, and thank you,"
Herman said loudly, reasserting himself as the leader.
"Thanks,"
Nicholas said. Scotty Mangrum announced to the court as soon as the jury was settled and happy that he was finished with Dr. Kilvan. Durr Cable began a cross-examination so delicate that he seemed thoroughly intimidated by the great expert. They agreed on a few statistics that were undoubtedly meaningless. Dr. Kilvan stated that through his plethora of numbers, he believed that about 10% of all smokers actually get lung cancer. Cable reinforced the point, something he'd done from the beginning and something he would do to the very end.
"So, Dr. Kilvan, if smoking causes lung cancer, then why do so few smokers get lung cancer?"
"Smoking greatly increases the risk of lung cancer."
"But it doesn't cause it every time, does it?"
"No, not every smoker gets lung cancer."
"Thank you.
But for those who smoke, the risk of lung cancer is much greater."
Cable warmed to the task and began to press. He asked Dr. Kilvan if he was familiar with a 20-year-old study from the University of Chicago in which researchers found a greater incidence of lung cancer for smokers who lived in metropolitan areas than for smokers who lived in rural areas. Kilvan was very familiar with the study, though he had nothing to do with it.
"Can you explain it?" Cable asked.
"No."
"Can you venture a guess?"
"Yes. It was a controversial study when it came out, because it indicated factors other than tobacco smoke might cause lung cancer."
"Such as air pollution?"
"Yes."
"Do you believe this?"
"It's possible."
"So you admit that air pollution causes lung cancer?"
"It might. But I stand by my research. Rural smokers get lung cancer more than rural non-smokers, and urban smokers get cancer more than urban non-smokers."
Cable lifted another thick report and made an event of flipping pages.
He asked Dr. Kilvan if he was familiar with a 1989 study at the University of Stockholm in which researchers determined that there was a link between heredity and smoking and lung cancer.
"I read that report," Dr. Kilvan said. "Do you have an opinion on it?"
"No. Heredity is not my specialty."
"So you can't say yes or no on the issue of whether heredity might be related to smoking and lung cancer?"
"I cannot."
"But you don't contest this report, do you?"
"I don't have a position on the report."
"Do you know the experts who conducted the research?"
"No."
"So you can't tell us if they're qualified or not?"
"No. I'm sure you've talked to them."
Cable walked to his table, swapped reports, and walked back to the lectern. After 2 weeks of severe scrutiny but little movement, Pynex stock suddenly had a reason to stir. Other than the impromptu Pledge of Allegiance, a phenomenon that so baffled the courtroom no one could decipher its meaning, the trial had produced virtually no high drama until late Monday afternoon when the jury was shaken. One of the many defense lawyers let it slip to one of the many financial analysts that Stella Hulick was generally deemed to be a decent defense juror. This got repeated a few times, and with each telling, Stella's significance to the tobacco industry rose to new heights. By the time the calls were made to New York, the defense had lost its most prized possession, Stella Hulick, who was by then home on the sofa in a martini-induced coma. Added to the rumor mill was the delicious bit about the break-in of Juror Easter's apartment. It was easy to assume the intruder was paid by the tobacco industry, and since they'd been caught, or at least were highly suspected, things looked bad all around for the defense. They'd lost a juror, they'd got caught cheating, the sky was falling. Pynex opened Tuesday morning at 79.5, quickly fell to 78 in trading that became heavier as the morning progressed and the rumors mushroomed. It was at 76.25 by mid-morning when a fresh report was received from Biloxi. An analyst who was actually in the courtroom down there called his office with the news that the jury had refused to come out this morning, had in fact gone on strike because it was sick and tired of the boring testimony being offered by the plaintiff's experts. In seconds, the report was repeated 100 times, and it became a simple fact on the street that the jury down there was revolting against the plaintiff. The price jumped to 77, flew past 78, hit 79, and was nearing 80 by lunch. Chapter 15. Of the 6 women remaining on the jury, the one Fitch wanted most to nail was Ricky Coleman, the wholesome, pretty, 30-year-old mother of two. She earned $21,000 a year as a records administrator in a local hospital. Her husband earned $36,000 as a private pilot. They lived in a nice suburb with a manicured lawn and a $90,000 mortgage, and they each drove Japanese cars, both of which were paid for. They saved frugally and invested conservatively, $8,000 last year alone, in mutual funds. They were very active in a neighborhood church. She taught small kids in Sunday school, and he sang in the choir. Apparently, the Colemans had acquired no bad habits. Neither smoked, and there was no evidence they drank. He liked to jog and play tennis. She spent an hour a day at a health club. Because of the clean life and because of her background in health care, Fitch feared her as a juror. The medical records obtained from her OBGYN revealed nothing remarkable. 2 pregnancies with perfect deliveries and recoveries. The annual checkups were done on time. A mammography 2 years ago showed nothing unusual. She was 5 feet 5 inches, 116 pounds. Fitch had medical records for 7 of the 12 jurors. Easter's couldn't be found, for obvious reasons. Herman Grimes was blind and had nothing to hide. Savelle was new and Fitch was digging. Lonnie Shaver hadn't been to the doctor in at least 20 years. Sylvia Taylor Tatum's doctor had been killed months earlier in a boating accident, and his successor was a rookie who didn't know how the game was played. The game was serious hardball, and Fitch had written most of the rules. Each year, the fund contributed $1 million to an organization known as the Judicial Reform Alliance, a noisy presence in Washington funded primarily by insurance companies, medical associations, and manufacturing groups. And tobacco companies. The Big Four reported annual contributions of $100,000 each, with Fitch and the fund sliding another $1 million under the door.
The purpose of JRA was to lobby for laws to restrict the size of awards in damage suits, specifically to eliminate the nuisance of punitive damages. Luther Vandermeer, CEO of Trelco, was a vocal member of the JRA board, and with Fitch quietly calling the shots, Vandermeer often ran roughshod over the members of the organization. Fitch wasn't seen, but he got what he wanted. Through Vandermeer and JRA, Fitch put enormous pressure on the insurance companies, which in turn put pressure on various local doctors, who in turn leaked sensitive and thoroughly confidential records of selected patients. So when Fitch wanted Dr. Dow and Biloxi to accidentally send the medical records for Mrs. Gladys Card to a nondescript post office box in Baltimore, he told Vandermeer to lean on contacts at St. Louis Mutual, Dr. Dow's malpractice carrier. Dr. Dow was told by St. Louis Mutual that his liability coverage might be dropped if he didn't play the game, and he became altogether happy to comply. Fitch had quite a collection of medical records, but nothing so far that might turn a verdict. His luck changed during lunch on Tuesday. When Ricky Coleman was still Ricky Weld, she attended a small Bible college in Montgomery, Alabama, where she was very popular. Some of the prettier girls at the school were known to date boys from Auburn. As the routine investigation into her background progressed, Fitch's investigator in Montgomery got a hunch that Ricky probably had plenty of dates. Fitch pursued the hunch with serious arm-twisting through JRA, and after 2 weeks of dead-end probing, they finally found the right clinic. It was a small, private women's hospital in downtown Montgomery, one of only three places abortions were performed in the city at that time. During her junior year, a week after her 20th birthday, Ricky Weld had an abortion. And Fitch had the records. A phone call told him they were coming, and he laughed to himself as he picked the sheets off his fax machine. No name for the father, but that was fine. Ricky had met Rhea, her husband, a year after she finished college. At the time of the abortion, Rhea was a senior at Texas A&M, and it was doubtful the two had ever met. Fitch was willing to bet a ton of money the abortion was a dark secret, all but forgotten by Ricky and definitely never revealed to her husband. The motel was a Siesta Inn in Pass Christian, 30 minutes west along the coast. The trip was made by charter bus with Lou Dell and Willis riding up front with the driver and the 14 jurors scattered throughout the seats. No two sat together. Conversation was non-existent. They were tired and disheartened, already isolated and imprisoned, though they had yet to see their new temporary home. For the first 2 weeks of the trial, adjournment at 5 meant escape. They left hurriedly and raced back to reality, back to homes and kids and hot meals, back to errands and maybe the office. Adjournment now meant a chartered ride to another cell, where they were to be watched and monitored and protected from evil shadows out there somewhere. Only Nicholas Easter was delighted with sequestration, but he managed to look as dispirited as the rest. Harrison County had rented for them the entire first floor of one wing, 20 rooms in all, though only 19 would be needed. Lou Dell and Willis had separate rooms by the door leading to the main building, where the reception and restaurant were located. A large young deputy named Chuck had a room at the other end of the hallway, ostensibly to guard the door leading to a parking lot. The rooms were assigned by Judge Harkin himself. The bags had already been transported and placed, unopened and definitely uninspected. Keys were passed out like candy by Lou Dell, whose self-importance grew by the hour. Beds were kicked and inspected, doubles in every room for some reason. TVs were turned on to no avail, no programs, no news during sequestration, only movies from the motel station. Bathrooms were scrutinized, faucets checked, toilets flushed. 2 weeks here would seem like a year. The bus was, of course, followed by Fitch's boys. It left the courthouse with a police escort, cops in front and back on motorcycles. It was easy to track the cops. Two detectives working for Rohr also followed along. No one expected the location of the motel to remain a secret. Nicholas had Savelle on one side and Colonel Herrera on the other. The men's rooms were next to each other. The women were across the hall, as if segregation was necessary to prevent unauthorized frolicking. 5 minutes after unlocking the door, the walls began to close in, and 10 minutes later, Willis knocked loudly and inquired as to whether everything was okay.
"Just beautiful," Nicholas said, without opening the door.
The telephones had been removed, as had the minibars. A room at the end of the hall had been stripped of the beds and furnished with 2 round tables, phones, comfortable chairs, a large-screen TV, and a bar fully equipped with every possible non-alcoholic beverage. Someone dubbed it the party room, and it stuck. Each phone call had to be approved by one of their guardians, and no incoming calls were permitted. Emergencies would be handled through the front desk. In room 40, directly across the hall from the party room, the beds had also been removed and a makeshift dining table had been set up. No juror could leave the wing without prior approval from Judge Harkin or on-the-spot approval from Lou Dell or one of the deputies. There was no curfew because there was no place to go, but the party room closed at 10. Dinner was from 6 to 7, breakfast from 6 to 8:30, and they were not expected to eat en masse. They could come and go. They could fix a plate and go back to their rooms. Judge Harkin was deeply concerned about the quality of the food and wanted to be told each morning if there were complaints. Tuesday's smorgasbord was either fried chicken or broiled snapper with salads and plenty of vegetables. They were amazed at their appetites. For people who'd done nothing all day but remain seated and listen, most were weak with starvation by the time the food arrived at 6. Nicholas fixed the first plate and sat at the end of the table, where he engaged everyone in conversation and insisted they eat as a group. He was hyper and chipper and acted as if sequestration were nothing but an adventure. His enthusiasm was slightly contagious. Only Herman Grimes ate in his room. Mrs. Grimes prepared 2 plates and left in a rush. Judge Harkin had strict written instructions prohibiting her from eating with the jury. Same for Lou Dell and Willis and Chuck. So when Lou Dell entered the room with dinner in mind and found Nicholas in the middle of a tale, the conversation suddenly ceased. She flung a few green beans alongside a chicken breast and a dinner roll and left. They were a group now, isolated and exiled, cut off from reality and banished against their wishes to a siesta inn. They had no one but themselves. Easter was determined to keep them happy. They would be a fraternity, if not a family. He would work to avoid divisions and cliques. They watched 2 movies in the party room. By 10, they were all asleep.
"I'm ready for my conjugal visit," Jerry Fernandez announced over breakfast, in the general direction of Mrs. Gladys Card, who blushed.
"Really?"
she said, rolling her eyes toward the ceiling. Jerry smiled at her as if she might be the object of his longing. Breakfast was a veritable feast of everything from fried ham to cornflakes. Nicholas arrived mid-meal with a soft hello to the group and a troubled countenance.
"I don't understand why we can't have telephones," were the first words from his mouth, and the pleasant morning mood suddenly turned sour. He sat across from Jerry, who read his face and caught on immediately.
"Why can't we have a cold beer?" Jerry asked. "I have a cold beer every night when I'm home, maybe 2. Who has the right to dictate what we can drink here?"
"Judge Harkin," said Millie Dupree, a woman who avoided alcohol.
"I'll be damned."
"And what about television?" Nicholas asked. "Why can't we watch television? I've been watching television since the trial started, and I don't recall much excitement."
He turned to Loreen Duke, a large woman with a plateful of scrambled eggs.
"Have you seen any sudden news breaks with the latest from the trial?"
"Nope."
He looked at Ricky Coleman, who was sitting behind a tiny bowl of harmless flakes.
"And what about a gym? Someplace to go sweat after 8 hours in the courtroom. Surely they could have found a motel with a gym."
Ricky nodded her complete agreement.
Loreen swallowed her eggs and said, "What I don't understand is why can't we be trusted with a telephone? My kids might need to call me. It's not like some goon's going to call my room and threaten me."
"I'd just like a cold beer or two," Jerry said.
"And maybe a few more conjugal visits," he added,
again looking at Mrs. Gladys Card. The grumbling gathered speed around the table, and within 10 minutes of Easter's arrival, the jurors were on the verge of revolt. The random irritations were now a full-fledged list of abuses. Even Herrera, the retired colonel who'd camped in jungles, was not pleased with the selection of beverages offered in the party room.
Millie Dupree objected to the absence of newspapers. Lonnie Shaver had pressing business and deeply resented the notion of sequestration in the first place.
"I can think for myself," he said. "No one can influence me."
At the least, he needed an unrestricted telephone. Philip Savelle did yoga in the woods each morning at dawn alone, just himself communing with nature, and there wasn't a tree within 200 yards of the motel. And what about church? Mrs. Card was a devout Baptist who never missed prayer meeting on Wednesday nights and visitation on Tuesdays and WMU on Fridays, and of course the Sabbath was crammed full of meetings.
"We'd better get things straight now," Nicholas said solemnly. "We're going to be here for 2 weeks, maybe three. I say we get Judge Harkin's attention."
Judge Harkin had 9 lawyers packed into his chambers, haggling over the daily issues to be kept away from the jury. He required the lawyers to appear each morning at 8 for the warm-up bouts, and he often made them stay an hour or two after the jury left. A heavy knock interrupted a heated debate between Roar and Cable. Gloria Lane pushed the door open until it hit a chair occupied by Oliver McAdoo.
"We have a problem with the jury," she said gravely.
Harkin jumped to his feet.
"What?" "They want to talk to you, that's all I know."
Harkin looked at his watch. "Where are they?"
"At the motel."
"Can't we get them over here?"
"No, we've tried. They're not coming until they talk to you."
His shoulders sagged and his mouth hung open.
"This is getting ridiculous," Wendell Rohr offered to no one in particular.
The lawyers watched the judge, who looked absently at the pile of papers on his desk and collected his thoughts. Then he rubbed his hands together and gave them all a huge, phony smile. "Let's go see him." Conrad took the first call at 8:02. She didn't want to talk to Fitch, just wanted to give him the message that the jury was once again perturbed and not coming out until Harkin hauled himself over to the Siesta Inn and unruffled their feathers. Conrad ran to Fitch's room and delivered the message. At 8:09, she called again and gave Conrad the information that Easter would be wearing a dark denim shirt over a tan T-shirt with red socks and the usual starched khakis. "Red socks," she repeated. At 8:12, she called for the third time and asked to speak to Fitch, who was pacing around his desk and pulling on his goatee. He clenched the receiver.
"Hello?"
"Good morning, Fitch," she said.
"Good morning, Marley.
You ever been to the St. Regis Hotel in New Orleans?"
"No."
"It's on Canal Street in the French Quarter. There's an open-air bar on the roof. It's called the Terrace Grill. Get a table overlooking the quarter. Be there at 7 tonight. I'll be there later. Are you with me?"
"Yes."
"And come by yourself, Fitch. I'll watch you enter the hotel, and if you bring friends, the meeting's off, okay?"
"Okay."
"And if you attempt to trail me, then I disappear."
"You have my word."
"Why am I not comforted by your word, Fitch?"
She hung up. Cable, Rohr, and Judge Harkin were met at the front desk by Lou Dell, who was flustered and scared and rattling on about how this had never happened to her. She'd always kept her juries under control. She led them to the party room, where 13 of the 14 jurors were holed up. Herman Grimes was the lone dissenter. He had argued with the group about their tactics and had angered Jerry Fernandez to the point of getting himself insulted. Jerry had pointed out that Herman had his wife with him, that he had no use for either televisions or newspapers, didn't drink anymore, and probably didn't need a gym. Jerry apologized after Millie Dupree asked him to. If His Honor had a chip on his shoulder, it didn't last long. After a few uncertain hellos and good mornings, he said, starting badly,
"I'm a little bit disturbed by this."
To which Nicholas Easter responded, "We're not in the mood to take any abuse." Rohr and Cable had been expressly forbidden from speaking, and they hung near the door and watched with great amusement. Both knew this was a scene unlikely to be repeated in their litigating careers. Nicholas had written down their list of complaints. Judge Harkin removed his coat, took a seat, and was soon hammered from all directions. He was pitifully outnumbered and virtually defenseless. Beer was no problem. Newspapers could be censored by the front desk. Unrestricted phone calls made perfect sense.
Same for televisions, but only if they promise not to watch the local news. The gym might be a problem, but he'd look into it. Visits to church could be arranged. In fact, everything was flexible.
"Can you explain why we're here?" Lonnie Shaver demanded.
He tried. He cleared his throat and reluctantly attempted to justify his reasons for locking them away. He rambled for a bit about unauthorized contact, about what had happened so far with this jury, and he made some vague references to events that had occurred in other tobacco trials. The misconduct was well documented, and both sides had been guilty in the past. Fitch had left a wide trail across the landscape of tobacco litigation. Operatives for some of the plaintiff's lawyers in other cases had done dirty deeds. But Judge Harkin couldn't talk about them in front of his jury. He had to be careful and not prejudice either side. The meeting lasted an hour. Harkin asked for a no-strike guarantee in the future, but Easter wouldn't commit. Pinex opened down 2 points on news of a second strike, which, according to an analyst waiting in the courtroom, was caused by an ill-defined negative reaction by the jurors to certain tactics employed the day before by the defense team. The tactics were also ill-defined. A second rumor by another analyst in Biloxi cleared things up a little by speculating that no one in the courtroom knew for certain exactly why the jury was on strike. The stock moved half a point lower before correcting itself and inching upward in the early morning trading. The tar in cigarettes causes cancer, at least in laboratory rodents. Dr. James Euchre from Palo Alto had worked with mice and rats for the past 15 years. He'd conducted many studies himself, and he'd studied extensively the work of researchers around the world. At least 6 major studies had, in his opinion, conclusively linked cigarette smoking with lung cancer. In great detail, he explained to the jury exactly how he and his team had taken tobacco smoke condensates, usually referred to simply as tars, and rubbed them directly onto the skin of what looked like 1 million white mice. The pictures were large and in color. The lucky mice got just a touch of tar, the others got fairly painted. To no one's surprise, the heavier the tar, the quicker skin cancer developed. It's a long way from surface tumors on rodents to lung cancer in humans, and Dr. Euchre, with Rohr leading the way, couldn't wait to link the two. Medical history is filled with studies in which laboratory findings have ultimately been proven to apply to humans. Exceptions have been rare. Though mice and humans live in vastly different environments, the results in some animal tests are fully consistent with the epidemiologic findings in humans. Every available jury consultant was in the courtroom during Euchre's testimony. Disgusting little rodents were one thing, but rabbits and beagles could be cuddly pets. Euchre's next study involved a similar plastering of tar on rabbits, with virtually the same results. His last test involved 30 beagles, which he taught to smoke through tubes in their tracheas. The heavy smokers worked their way up to 9 cigarettes a day, the equivalent of about 40 cigarettes for a 150-pound man. In these dogs, serious lung damage in the form of invasive tumors was detected after 875 consecutive days of smoking. Euchre used dogs because they exhibit the same reaction to cigarette smoking as do humans. He would not, however, get to tell this jury about his rabbits and his beagles. An untrained amateur could look at Millie Dupree's face and tell she felt very sorry for the mice and held a grudge against Euchre for killing them. Sylvia Taylor Tatum and Angel Wees also expressed overt signs of displeasure. Mrs. Gladys Card and Philip Savelle emitted subtle evidence of disapproval. The other men were unmoved. Rohr and company made the decision during lunch to forego more testimony from James Euchre. Chapter 16. Jumper, the courtroom deputy who took the note from Marley 13 days earlier and handed it to Fitch, was approached during lunch and offered $5,000 cash to call in sick with stomach cramps or diarrhea or some such affliction, and travel in plain clothes with Pang to New Orleans for a night of food, fun, perhaps a call girl if Jumper was so inclined. Pang needed only a few hours of light work from him. Jumper needed the money. They left Biloxi around 12:30 in a rented van. By the time they arrived in New Orleans 2 hours later, Jumper had been convinced to temporarily retire his uniform and work for Arlington West Associates for a while. Pang offered him $25,000 for 6 months' work, $9,000 more than he was presently earning for an entire year. They checked into their rooms at the St. Regis, two single rooms on each side of Fitch, who'd been able to extort only four from the hotel. Holly's room was down the hall. Dubaz, Joe Boy, and Dante were four blocks away in the Royal Sonesta. Jumper was first parked on a bar stool in the lounge, where he had a view of the front entrance of the hotel. The waiting began. There was no sign of her as the afternoon dragged toward dark, and no one was surprised. Jumper was moved four times and swiftly tired of shadow work. Fitch left his room a few minutes before seven and rode the elevator to the roof. His table was in a corner with a nice view of the quarter. Holly and Dubaz were at a table 10 feet away, both well-dressed and seemingly oblivious to everyone. Dante and a hired escort in a black miniskirt had another table. Joe Boy would take the pictures. At 7:30, she appeared from nowhere. Neither Jumper nor Pang reported seeing her anywhere near the front lobby. She simply emerged through the open French doors on the roof and was at Fitch's table in an instant. He later speculated that she did what they had done, got a room at the hotel under another name and used the stairs. She was dressed in slacks and jacket and very pretty. Dark, short hair, brown eyes, strong chin and cheeks, very little makeup, but then little was needed. He guessed her age to be between 28 and 32. She sat quickly, so fast, in fact, that Fitch didn't get the chance to offer her a chair. She sat directly across from him with her back to the other tables. "A pleasure to meet you," he said softly, glancing around at the other tables to see if anyone was listening.
"Yes, a real pleasure," she replied, leaning on her elbows.
The waiter appeared with rapid efficiency and asked if she wanted something to drink. No, she did not. The waiter had been bribed with hard cash to carefully remove anything she touched with her fingers, glasses, plates, silver, ashtrays, anything. He would not get the chance. "Are you hungry?" Fitch asked, sipping a mineral water.
"No, I'm in a hurry."
"Why?"
"Because the longer I sit here, the more photos your goons can take."
"I came alone."
"Of course you did. How'd you like the Red Sox?"
A jazz band began across the roof, but she ignored it. Her eyes never left Fitch's. Fitch rolled his head back and offered a snort. It was still difficult to believe he was chatting with the lover of one of his jurors. He'd had indirect contact with jurors before, several times in different forms, but never this close. And she came to him. "Where's he from?" Fitch asked.
"What difference does it make? He's here."
"Is he your husband?"
"No."
"Boyfriend?"
"You ask a lot of questions."
"You present a lot of questions, young lady, and you expect me to ask them."
"He's an acquaintance."
"When did he assume the name Nicholas Easter?"
"What difference does it make? That's his legal name. He's a legal resident of Mississippi, a registered voter. He can change his name once a month if he wants."
She kept her hands tucked together under her chin. He knew she would not make the mistake of leaving prints. "What about you?" Fitch asked.
"Me?"
"Yeah, you're not registered to vote in Mississippi."
"How do you know?"
"Because we checked. Assuming, of course, your real name is Marley and that it's spelled properly."
"You're assuming too much."
"It's my job. Are you from the coast?"
"No."
Joe Boy leaned down low between two plastic boxwoods just long enough to take 6 shots of the side of her face. A decent view would require a tightrope act on top of the brick banister 18 floors above canal. He'd stay in the greenery and hope for something better when she left. Fitch rattled the ice in his glass. "So why are we here?" he asked.
"One meeting leads to another."
"And where do all the meetings lead us?"
"To the verdict."
"For a fee, I'm sure."
"Fee has an awfully small ring to it. Are you recording this?"
She knew perfectly well Fitch was recording every sound. "Of course not."
He could play the tape in his sleep for all she cared.
He had nothing to gain by sharing it with anyone. He carried too much baggage to run to the cops or to the judge, and that didn't fit into his modus operandi anyway. The thought of blackmailing her with the authorities never occurred to Fitch, and she knew this too. He could take all the photos he wanted. and he and his thugs scattered around the hotel could follow and watch and listen. She'd play along for a while, dodging and darting and making them work for their money. They'd find nothing.
Let's not talk about money now, okay, Fitch?
We'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. This is your show.
Why'd you break into his apartment?
That's just what we do.
How do you read Herman Grimes? She asked.
Why do you ask me? You know exactly what's happening in the jury room.
I want to see how smart you are. I'm interested in knowing if you're getting your money's worth from all those jury experts and lawyers.
I've never lost, so I always get my money's worth.
So what about Herman?
Fitch thought for a second and motioned for another glass of water. He'll have a lot to do with the verdict because he's a man of strong opinions. Right now, he's open-minded. He absorbs every word in court and probably knows more than every other juror, with the exception, of course, of your friend. Am I right?
You're pretty close.
That's good to hear.